The first reading this morning comes from the late and influential United States poet Adrienne Rich. This reading consists of a few lines excerpted from her much longer poem Sources, found in her book Native Land, Your Life, written all the way back in 1986.
It's an old-fashioned, an outrageous thing to believe that one has a destiny. A thought often peculiar to those who possess privilege. But there is something else, the faith of those despised and endangered, that they are not merely the sum of damages done to them. They have kept beyond violence the knowledge of being a connecting link in a long, continuous way.
The second reading is from The Selma Awakening, a book by my friend and colleague Mark Morrison Reed, who has preached in this pulpit before and who will be here on Thursday night for a potluck around 6:15 and to read from his book and several of his other books, to show some slides, make a presentation, and I made it a little bit early so that people in the chalice choir who have rehearsal that night might be able to come for at least a little bit. And our bookstore, I think, still has some copies of his book, and it's a great book, his best book, I think. So in this particular part of the reading from The Selma Awakening, he's talking about the After Selma Committee, which was a group of Unitarian Universalists who tried to understand what happened when so many of our ministers went to Selma in 64 and were completely transformed by that event.
The After Selma Committee processed what it had learned from the UUA's involvement in Selma. An amazing aspect of that meeting was the discussion of white privilege. In 1965, this terminology had not yet entered into the social justice vernacular. Indeed, the most widely known essay on the topic, Peggy McIntosh's White Privilege, Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack, was not published until 1989. Exploring that idea and then linking it to class oppression was farsighted, even if the committee had little idea of how to approach the issue beyond the necessity of fostering collaborative relationships. The After Selma Committee missed many things. Its members tended to portray the problems and challenges as extrinsic to Unitarian Universalism. They leaned toward making prejudice and segregation the culprits. They saw these as the causes of discrimination in employment, housing, and educational opportunity. In the aftermath of Selma, many UUs, scrambling to live out the lessons they had learned, recommitted themselves to the cause of freedom and equality. Unitarian Universalists came at it the only way they could. They expected to be able to live where they wanted, to go to school where they wish, to vote, to be employed in an occupation commensurate with their education, and saw the injustice that African Americans could not do likewise. However, buffered as they were from prejudice and social stigma, they did not understand that their earnest yearning, fair-mindedness, and good deeds would not suffice, or foresee that changing laws would not be sufficient. Thank you.
I seem to remember it was my second year here as your senior minister when I had a transformative conversation with a colleague. Not a Unitarian Universalist colleague, mind you, like the ones that Eric and Lane and I will be spending time with this week, but a Bread colleague, Bread being our multi-faith social justice organization. It happened to be the minister at the First African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church down on Bryden Road, a church where just a few years later I had the privilege of preaching a Good Friday homily at this same colleague's request. We had become friends by then. What a day that was. So both of us had just pulled into the parking lot of a Methodist church way out on the Far East Side where we were holding the clergy meeting that late September morning. I parked. He parked. We got out, recognized we didn't know each other, shook hands, met, and started to walk and talk together across the parking lot toward the entrance. He told me he had just moved here from New Jersey at his bishop's request to serve his new post on Bryden. The impact of the move was still upon him. New stores, he complained, new roads, new streets, new directions, new banks, new Midwestern culture, even new English pronunciations, which are very different from how we speak English in New Jersey. I smiled in sympathy, saying, I agree. Moving is very, very tough on the soul. It's one of the hardest things I've ever done. And then he abruptly asked me, what the hell is going on here in Columbus, Ohio? What? I said, not exactly knowing where he was going since he had already been complaining about all the problems with the move. What do you mean? I said. He said, well, the police are different here than the police force where I used to live in New Jersey. I've been here only 6 weeks. I arrived mid-August. And I have already been pulled over six times for DWB. Now, as I always tell people, the part of my brain that can interpret acronyms withered and died some time ago. So I said, DWB? He laughed and he said, yeah, driving while black. You never heard that phrase, he asked me, DWB? Well, no, up to now I hadn't, I said to him. Yeah, well, I wasn't speeding, I wasn't drinking, I wasn't going through lights, my tailpipe wasn't belching blue smoke, nothing, just DWB. Of course, a lot of folks, he laughed, of whatever color, tell me they don't believe me when I tell them this, since 6 times in 6 weeks is patently so over the top that it really is unbelievable. Sometimes I have a hard time believing it myself, but it's true. It happened. I wasn't given a single ticket. I was just asked a lot of stupid questions about where I was going. And it was a complete waste of my time. Oh my God, I said, I can't imagine how they can get away with doing things like that. 6 times in 6 weeks? It's downright criminal, I think. But then I thought for a minute and I told him that I had noticed something. I told him that I had noticed and commented to other people that I had noticed this, that if I drove up here from where I live downtown, not on 315 or 71, but took 4th, you know, side streets, ordinary street side streets, I would always notice a disproportionate number of people, all African American, pulled over by cops in the neighborhood above 5th Avenue and below Clintonville. No one was ever pulled over in Clintonville. Years later, After I had taught Jordan Argus, the son of Pam Argus of this congregation, how to drive a stick shift at his request, since that's not really taught anymore in driver's ed, he reported to me, once he started driving, that the same thing used to happen to him over and over again, too. DWB, driving while black, over and over and over. I told my new colleague, it's like the people who pulled you over are operating under a totally different system of law. He said, that's exactly what it is. It's standard white privilege. Do you know where the word privilege comes from, he asked me. Well, no, I never looked that up, I said. Latin roots, it sounds like. He said, yep, exactly, Latin roots. The PRIV is a short form of the word privatus, meaning obviously private. And the leg, although sounded with a soft G, is actually the word leges, plural for lex, meaning law. It means laws. Private laws, I said, receiving an insight about the word privilege for the very first time. Private laws. Yeah, he said, you got it. Private laws. Laws that don't answer to the courts of this land. Laws that are not voted on or legislated. Laws that are not in any book anywhere, but are communicated, nevertheless, by the silent culture which holds all of us, no matter what our color, in its very sticky web. Now that memory from my early years here at First Columbus really got to me, still lives inside me. And it made me leap for joy when we together crafted the following sentence in our mission statement. We are here to relinquish the safety of our unexamined privilege for the freedom to engage in transforming justice. Unexamined privilege, we say. The adjective is important. Not all privilege, after all, as bell hooks and Amelia Mesa Bain say, is hurtful to others. Privilege does not have to be negative, they write. But we do have to share our resources and take directions about how to use our privilege in ways to empower those who lack it. Exactly. Although I bet the phrase take direction raises a few hackles around here, right? But still, most privilege that I know of, white privilege, male privilege, heterosexual privilege, is just that, unexamined. Deshaun Stokes even goes further down that road of definition, calling such privilege, more specifically, unearned. And people are so upset by that definition, he says, that they balk, calling any challenge to such privileges as being merely PC or politically correct. A phrase designed and meant to shrink any protest right down to dust. Fox News, of course, is the master of this particular game. Listen to how many times they use it. So let me give you some examples of privileges that are unearned and often unexamined. Now, you all well know that it's possible in some of the states in these United States for two men to get married legally or two women to get married legally, which means that if one of them goes to the hospital, has a heart attack, it happens. The others can visit legally because they're considered next of kin. They can even go all the way into the intensive care unit. Here in Ohio, someone who has been together with her or his partner for 30 years can still be turned away unless there is a staff member who simply doesn't care about such things. And fortunately, that's most often the case these days. But that's just happenstance. Worse, you don't know how many times I have run into same-gender couples where one of them suddenly dies. Heart attack, it happens, you know. And the family of the other one, the one who died, comes and takes away everything in the house they kept together because the couple hadn't gotten around yet to spending the tens of thousands of dollars it takes to get all of the privileges automatically granted by heterosexual marriage. And, God help us, if the other fellow's name is not already on the house documents, they are summarily kicked out of the house as it is sold from right under their feet. I have heard this story at least 20 times in the last 20 years. When my best friend died, Stefan, Richard, his partner, was not granted family grief leave because the law in California back then did not consider Richard and Stefan to be family. Richard had to take vacation time to bury his spouse and sit Shiva, his Jewish religious custom. Thank God he had saved up at least that much vacation time because Shiva is 8 full days all by itself. He was not granted the universal privilege of support for his huge and debilitating grief. He was being treated that way by an unwritten private law, a law which allowed certain powerful people in state and church to define what family meant without ever writing a single word down. It was an assumed privilege, an assumed private law that granted ordinary human rights to the majority and took them from the minority. Leave it to our benighted state of Ohio, however, to actually make it law in the land in written form, in the defense of marriage wording, which pretty much says that the wedding of two men that I am going to officiate in next week, they're rehearsing here this afternoon, is against the state law. They had to get legally married in Massachusetts. Not as cheap, you may agree, as just driving downtown to get a marriage license here. But as Bell Hooks said, some privilege can be used to help others when they're denied privilege. I could use my privilege, and yes, it is a privilege, and I'm very grateful for it. I can use my privilege of being clergy to visit Stefan in places in the hospital where Richard was simply not allowed to go. If I had just said I was Stefan's friend, that wouldn't have worked, because all families of the heart are outside the law as well. Adrian Rich, poet I much love, makes a bold statement about the word privilege. And she made it in 1986, which was 3 years before that book that Mark Morrison Reed talks about, White Privilege, Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack. It's an old-fashioned, outrageous thing, she says, to believe that one has a destiny, a thought often peculiar to those who possess privilege. There you have, in one sentence, a summary of the whole of American history, horribly distorted by what our great historians, all of them, call manifest destiny, and which was a very popular, although fortunately not uncontested, belief in this nation in its first 100 years. The privileged colonial whites in this nation believed it was their destiny to own all of the continent out to the Pacific and to bring the agrarian life of the East out to the West. They declared war against Mexico precisely because of this belief, rooted in privilege, even though President Lincoln was against this belief, and the whole Whig Party, now defunct, was against it, the Democrats of that day really made it central to their policies, sad to say. This meant that the native populations were simply in the way of destiny. And the white colonial population claimed as their privilege the eternal right to refer to the natives of this land by the dehumanizing term savages in all of their legal documents written down, as well as in the unwritten private law that governed their imperial attitude. It made it so much easier to get rid of them. Later, during the lynching era, white privilege, private laws, simply disregarded public law, which says, as you've heard, everyone is innocent until proven guilty. White privilege simply equated skin color with guilt and strung up whoever they pleased. As I've said before in this pulpit, the largest single lynching in these states was not of black people, but of Italian immigrants in Louisiana. Italian immigrants eventually earned the right to be white over a period of about 40 years. At the time of the lynching I'm talking about, however, they still were not considered white, and they died a horrible death. Mark Morrison Reed suggests in his book that although our clergy went down to Selma in amazing numbers, more than any other religious association, and points out that several of our colleagues were killed or beaten at that time, James Reeb is the most famous example, the idea of white privilege was still a very difficult idea for many Unitarian Universalists of that era to get, because most of them were white. It was hard for them to see the invisible but quite real systemization of all racial politics. He writes that although they actually started out by naming white privilege, and he says long before the phrase was actually in use, the After Selma Committee missed many things. Its members tended to portray problems and challenges as extrinsic to, that's the 50-cent word for outside of, Unitarian Universalism. It's someone else doing this, not us. They leaned toward making prejudice and segregation elsewhere as the culprits. They saw these as the causes of discrimination in employment, housing, and educational opportunity. In the aftermath of Selma, many Unitarian Universalists scrambled to live out the lessons they had learned and recommitted themselves, Mark says, to the cause of freedom and equality. But then he adds, Unitarian Universalists came at it the only way they could. And right here, Mark describes what white privilege actually looks like. He writes, they expected to be able to live where they wanted, to go to school where they wanted, to vote, to be employed in an occupation commensurate with their education. He adds that, yeah, they saw the injustice that African Americans could not do likewise. However, buffered as they were from prejudice and social stigma themselves, he writes, they did not understand that their earnest yearning, fair-mindedness, and good deeds would not suffice, or foresee that changing laws, meaning written laws, would simply not be sufficient. Right, not sufficient, because privilege, private laws, are not written down. Thus, you can't change them by some socially progressive legislation with fresh ink on fresh paper. To speak of the present events in Ferguson, Missouri, for example, as if it was only a matter of crude prejudice on the part of the man who shot the young man is a little like saying that the stars of the Pleiades are actually dancing children up in the sky. They are not. We know better now. And knowing better is important. It's not a fix, but it's the first step. You can only change what is invisible by dealing with people and their insides, not with policies on paper. You have to ask people to learn real history in their compassionate hearts. They're undeniably compassionate hearts. History from Bacon's Rebellion in 1676, which started all this racialized nonsense, to Mr. Jefferson's very complex and difficult mix of complete denial, privilege, and vision, real vision, through the Civil War, Reconstruction, the lynching and Jim Crow eras, and the Civil Rights era, especially Selma. It also means learning with Michelle Alexander, a wonderful Columbus writer, about what it means to talk about the new Jim Crow in our present era. It means to see what we are told not to see. That's a strong sentence, and I found that in the poem we read this morning as the affirmation from a Mohawk Canadian poet. I will see you. For every eye that refused to look, my own eyes will cover you with respect. I will cry with you for lost language. The Mohawk language I showed you earlier almost disappeared. It was resuscitated. I will laugh with you. I will stand with you. I will give you what you have given me. Oh, how I wish I had those words to say to my AME Zion colleague when he was telling me his story in the parking lot. But his story, and the hundreds I've heard since, just like them, even in the President Obama era, have grabbed my soul and kindled my dedication to spend the rest of my days, as our mission puts it, relinquishing the safety of not working on these issues, whether we're talking about people of color, women, sexual minorities, gender minorities, who are denied by privilege, participating in universal privilege, that is, universal human rights. And I'm making it my personal mission to never, ever, ever look away.